in army-hit areas, and also involved in evangelism. When asked about this, one of the trustees said, "All Christian charities try to convert people. There's nothing unusual about OMF in that respect." Really? Well, I'm going to have to disagree with OMF trustee on that matter. Christian Aid is not in the business of converting people. And what's more, there are good reasons why. I want to give you three reasons why, particularly in emergency situations, aid and evangelism don't mix. I'll give you the list first. It's immoral, it's dangerous, and it's bad aid delivery. On the whole, I think that's a pretty compelling list, but let's go through them in turn and look at them a bit longer. As you're agreeing about audience, I thought we'd start with immorality, because you'll feel right at home. In any situation where aid is delivered by one group to another, but much more so in emergency situations, there's a power relationship set up. If you have food and resources, you have power, and if you have nothing, then you have nothing. Now, there are things you can do to try and even up that power relationship. You can try and involve the local community in the aid distribution program. That's the most important thing. But whatever you do, there's a disparity in power, and it's very easy to exploit. In Rwanda, when the genocide was going on and people were fleeing across the borders to the refugee camps in neighbouring countries, there were lots of incidents where aid was used to coerce people into changing faith. Come to a prayer meeting and you have food. Pick up a Bible and you'll get shelter. It's an appalling abuse of power because a starving, hungry, shelterless person is in no position to refuse. But the abuse of power is also a little more subtle than that. Many individuals, us included, struggle with questions of faith when disaster comes. Where was God in the tsunami? People who were affected by it, who lost their families, were actually struggling with their faith at that point, whatever their faith was. And I have to wonder about the morality of saying to people of other faiths, "Your God cost you your life, my God's bringing you aid." The "my God is bigger than your God" argument, especially when people are vulnerable, is deeply, deeply immoral. Number two on the list. It's dangerous. At least it is in many places in the world. In a lot of parts of the world, conflict is one of the key things that creates and drives poverty. And conflict divides people across all sorts of lines and barriers. Ethnicity, religion. Religion's crucial. We can see that in the kind of situation developing in Iraq where, whatever the truth of the situation, the conflict between the West and Iraq has taken on religious overtones of Christians against the Islamic world. Whatever happens, or what happens then, when aid groups, especially in this case some of the American groups, as the USA is seen as the worst offender in Iraq, start distributing Bibles with aid? What happens is it becomes dangerous. Aid becomes synonymous with Christianity, which is synonymous with the invading forces, which makes aid agencies targets in war. And we've seen it happen. We've seen aid become politicized and become dangerous. Whenever there's a conflict situation and religion is part of the origin of the conflict, then tying aid and evangelism makes aid agencies, neutral groupings, suddenly targets. It's not something I want to do. But it can also be dangerous for the indigenous population. The aggressive tactics of some American evangelistic groups in Iraq have made the local Christian population targets. For a long while, the Christian and Islamic communities have existed side by side in that country in a kind of live and let live fashion. But now the intrusion of outside organizations has made local Christians targets, because all Christians are tarred with the same brush. So that's the second reason. It's dangerous. Third, it just makes for shockingly bad aid. If the delivery of aid becomes strongly allied to a religious viewpoint, such as when it's tied to evangelism, then you have a real problem. Aid is supposed to be delivered to those that need it most. It's a basic humanitarian objective. The people most in need get aid. But what if you're tying aid to evangelism? Well, that's precisely what's not going to happen. Why? Because aid gets delivered to those people that are prepared to come to your prayer meeting. the people that share your religion often. People who don't want to be converted, people who don't feel comfortable with your religion, stay away even if they're most in need. Even if they're the ones starving, they stay away. Working to specific religious aims, you narrow down the aid beneficiaries from those who actually need it to those that are prepared to come and be evangelised. And that means your aid gets wasted because it's not going to the right people. And there's another reason as well why aid delivery is hampered. Take Christian Aid's work in Afghanistan. Christian Aid had been working in Afghanistan for a long while, and we had a relationship with the Taliban authorities that allowed us to work there. The traditional kind of cultural traditions of hospitality in that country meant that they were prepared to accept Christian Aid as a development agency. Most of the people that ran the Taliban had come out of madrasas in various parts of the Islamic world. They knew a lot about the Quran, and they didn't know how to run a country. And they needed aid and development agencies in there to help look after the population. So they welcomed Christian Aid in as an organisation and as a faith-based organisation to help them out with aid programmes. But there were rules that had to be obeyed. And evangelism was one of the things that the Taliban would not allow. So when other Christian groups in Afghanistan started evangelizing and were consequently thrown out, as you may remember, the Christian Aid offices were raided by the police looking for Bibles. Someone had tipped them off that we were religious, and they turned up with their guns, raided the office and wrecked it. There was a real chance that Christian Aid would be thrown out of the country too. Now, the impact that that would have on the aid and development programs that we run is obvious. Our beneficiaries' lives were being put at risk by someone tying aid and evangelism. Very, very bad aid delivery. Evangelism and aid both matter, but they matter too much to get the two confused. They matter too much to try and do them together, because when we do, we're in danger of acting immorally. We're in danger of, well, we're causing great danger, and we're going to do both badly. We're supposed to do them well, so we have to keep them separate.
Well, as you can imagine, our coffee break had now taken us way past caffeine levels that were safe, and a whole pack of biscuits had disappeared. To be honest, the discussion wasn't as orderly as Nigel's summary of it, because I kept saying, but. The biggest but is the one that I'm feeling right now. It's that if we wanted to keep... Nigel.
He so wishes he'd actually written that joke now.
If I've lost the religious debate, Nigel, I've won the humour debate. The next thing I've got written down here is people are just not made that way, which suddenly means something completely different. Lives don't divide up easily into separate compartments, one of which eats bread and the other of which prays to God. People's spirituality and people's physicality are bound up together in one holistic life. In times of great need, people need help, but people also need hope. To provide both at the same time requires great sensitivity in order not to abuse the position they find themselves in. But that's no reason not to try. In the mainly Hindu Nicobar Islands, on which the tsunami had a devastating impact, relief camps are still, even now, offering temporary shelter to people who were made homeless by the force of the waves. On a road that leads to one of the camps, at the entrance of the offices of the organisation running it, there's a banner that reads, "Jesus Saves." There's nothing particularly unusual about that. There is, after all, a poster outside my church in Croydon saying something similar. In the Nicobar Islands, worshipping Christians are a tiny minority. And of course, exactly the same is true of Croydon. I wonder whether we can try and understand what's going on in the minds of the people who run organisations that are responding to poverty and crisis in the name of Jesus. And since Nigel quoted OMF International, why not take them as an example? This is, after all, the centenary of the death of their pioneering founder, James Hudson Taylor. He founded the China Inland Mission, which later became the Overseas Mission Fellowship 140 years ago. His objective was to take the good news to the parts of China where missionaries had never worked before. Outside the first office he set up, there was a banner declaring, "Have faith in God." Not so very different from the banner that's in the Nicobar Islands today. But from the very first, he became aware that a faith in God was not all that the Chinese needed. He observed opium addicts wrecking their lives, women who were treated by men in an abusive way, and villages where children died of trivial illnesses for lack of hygiene and basic medicine. He knew that becoming Christian would serve these people poorly if it still left them in a physically needy state. So alongside his development of churches, he used his doctor's training to start up refuges for recovering addicts, projects that brought Western and Eastern women alongside one another, and health centres. He dressed as Chinese gentlemen did, adopted Chinese culture, and went to serve. How could he do anything else? I think that helps us understand why evangelistic organisations working in Sri Lanka or India or Indonesia have made giving aid part of their work since the tsunami. If the good news of the kingdom of God really is good news, then when they see an overwhelming physical need amongst the people whose spiritual needs are close to their hearts, what can they do? Of course they offer medicine and food and shelter in a country in which they're already offering prayer and inner strength. People who have suffered a severe trauma have complex needs. Obviously they need somewhere to sleep safely and to be able to feed their children. But they need more. They need to grieve. They need a framework in which to understand what has happened to them. They need to repair hearts that are broken and spirits that are crushed. And they need to find hope. All these things relate to their spirituality. And about every one of these things, the gospel for which Jesus Christ lived and suffered and died and rose from the dead has something to say. When someone says, "Do I have anything left in this world about which to hope?" what kind of Christian responds, "I'm not here to tell you that. I'm just here to make sure you have clean water." Now, before I get carried away, I want to add some caveats that are designed to ensure that the excesses Nigel warned of, and which I shuddered at as well, don't take place. And like him, I want to make three suggestions. Firstly, in situations where people are destitute and in despair, the good news will only genuinely be good news if it's a response to what local people identify as something they need. To force the glorious Christian story of the resurrection that grew out of suffering and death on unwilling ears devalues both the story and the hearers. And in order for this to happen positively, partnership is vital. Partnership in this context means creating a relationship of equals between those from afar who have the resources to be able to finance this mission of hope and healing, and the churches in places where people are suffering who know what would be most helpful. In an evangelistic organisation for which I worked before Christian Aid, I remember being scornful of a request that came in from a partner organisation in Uganda, asking us to fund as a priority the purchase of 200 Anglican clerical collars. I remember writing a reply that I'm now ashamed of, questioning whether clerical collars were really going to forward the spirituality of African people in the 1970s. The response came back to me, "Our people are suffering great persecution. The homes of Christians are being attacked in the night and people are having to flee with no notice. When you're running for your life in terror, you need to be able to identify your leaders very quickly indeed. Clerical collars would be very helpful in doing that if you felt you could help us with them. This doesn't happen in Croydon. They receive them and a profound apology very quickly. So responding to locally identified need is vital, and so is building long-term relationships with people. When an agency enters a place, preaches, makes converts, and then disappears, it can only be perceived as letting down people whose lives have been changed by the intervention. It's not the model God has given us for evangelism. The model God has given us is emptying himself, making himself as helpless as a baby, and living among us, inhabiting human skin. More than that, in Jesus, God dignified and honoured human skin. Anything less than honouring the dignity of people who have looked to us in their hour of need is falling short of God's standards. I know it happens, and I know why. Because those who fund this kind of work want to hear reports that give a number of souls that they will believe will be in heaven because of the aid they have given. But most evangelistic organisations now know that this approach is counterproductive, and most evangelism now takes place through a building of relationships and a meeting of people who've come to love, trust, and want the best for each other over a long period of time. And the most immediate vehicle for communicating that love and trust is surely by working sacrificially alongside people, bringing healing, unburdening captives, releasing poor people from the poverty that traps them. In fact, the very things that Jesus announced he'd come to do. And finally, evangelism needs to follow Jesus' model of utter sensitivity to the context in which he found himself. It needs to delight in what is good in the context, be it secular or religious, in which it takes place. If Jesus went happily to eat with and enjoy the company of Samaritans and sex workers, declaring that they were ahead of his own religion in the queue to enter the kingdom of heaven, that is where evangelists need to find a happy home too. But equally, if Jesus was prepared to challenge abuse and injustice that he found in his society, as he did in his positive treatment of women and his refusal to ostracize people who lived with leprosy, then that too is the route that evangelism must take to be good news. Finding the balance between one and the other is desperately difficult. For instance, for Hudson Taylor, it led to discussions about whether condemning the binding of the feet of young Chinese girls to stunt their growth and make them dainty was a prophetic part of the Christian good news or a local cultural feature to honour. Today, the very same discussions might take place about female genital mutilation. Difficult, these questions. But evangelism always was difficult and dangerous, and liberating and healing and full of hope. That is what makes it good news. All those things inseparably mixed. Evangelism and aid both matter. They can be the salvation of people, of whole people who have complex needs that are impossible to untangle. That's why we need to do them well. But that's why we can't keep them separate.
Three all. Although goals scored away from home count more, so I'm up on aggregate. So you can see why we had such a compelling conversation and why we feel we've got as far as we can go without some help.
There's actually the one thing we ought to add at this point, and this is something which we completely agree about. Nigel?
Yeah, Christian aid, for many of the reasons we've discussed and many of the reasons I was talking about, is a signatory to the Red Cross Code of Conduct in Disaster Relief. It's a series of ethical standards drawn up in response to the kinds of issues that I've been raising to try and make sure that the excesses and abuses that can happen don't. There are many points in that code, but some of them are especially relevant to Christian aid. Point three. Aid will not be used to further a particular political or religious standpoint. Fairly obvious why that's relevant to this debate. Point five, we shall respect culture and custom. Again, evangelism, respecting culture and custom. Aid, respecting culture and custom. Difficult questions. Point seven, ways shall be found to involve program beneficiaries. What's that got to do with this debate? Well, if you want to involve people in the delivery and management of your aid, if you're tying that to an evangelistic message, then do people of the other religious communities want to be involved in helping manage your aid delivery program? So you begin to exclude people from aid management if you tie it to evangelism. So that's why I put that point in. And point 10, we shall recognize disaster victims as dignified human beings, not objects of pity.
Now, I think that those are things that we've both stressed in different ways in the last 20 minutes. We work with these rules because experience shows us that they work. They help deliver aid properly.
For me, doing this means keeping evangelism and aid separate. It means organisations working among the poorest people in Iraq should restrict themselves to giving aid. They won't understand the complex social structure of Iraqi society, the economic place of the Christians within it that makes them vulnerable, or the complex interactions between the Sunni and the Shia Muslims that form a religious powder keg against which aid delivery and evangelism happen.
But you see, for me, doing this means that a proper response to poverty or conflict or a natural disaster is to bring healing and hope together, and to work hard to make sure that we do them both well. It means that American groups in Iraq that are evangelizing the poorest people at the moment need to know and work alongside the local Christian community, which has been there longer than America has even existed. It hasn't happened. It does need to be happening better.
There's a wonderful piece in Mark's Gospel where Jesus has a long debate with the Sadducees, the Pharisees, the Herodians, and the priests, and we think we have trouble with seminar audiences. And they come to him not because they want answers, but because they want to trap him. Finally, a scribe approaches and I'm paraphrasing here, says, "Jesus, cut it out. Cut the parables, cut the trick answers, stop avoiding the issue. I'm serious. I want to know what it's all about. What's the point?" And Jesus almost wearily says, "Love God and love your neighbour. That's the point." That involves sharing our faith with people that follow another one or follow none. But it involves loving and caring for people regardless of what they believe, and loving them as an end in itself, not just because it's a means to convert them. We love and care for them because they're created by God and because they're precious. And we cannot stand by and watch them die in poverty through natural disasters or in conflict.
So we've got about 10 minutes to which anybody who wants to contribute to help us move on from this impasse we find ourselves at. Why don't you take a microphone that way, and I'll take a microphone that way, and we'll take one each. We might even take a straw poll at the end. Would you be interested in that? We'll see how we're going. Okay. Should I go first?
Yeah.
Peter, I don't think you quite answered some of Nigel's points. The things that interest me most were, firstly, is it ever possible, honestly and effectively, to deliver aid if there is a power dichotomy? One party has food, one party has nothing. And secondly, sorry, not to deliver aid, deliver the gospel plus aid. And secondly, the Afghanistan example, if you're delivering just aid, or if you're delivering aid plus gospel, with all that that's going to aggravate, surely you don't sacrifice your aid workers. And you haven't addressed either of those points.
I'm anxious at the moment to take as many points we can from the... I'm so sorry. You're all right. Do you need hope or healing?
It's okay. Peter's there. He can deliver both together.
Nigel.
I wanted to add that if some of the problems are those of perception amongst the community that's receiving the aid of what the objectives of the organisation is that's there, then whatever, we may be able to have a quite detailed discussion of careful ways of planning these things, but we can never control the perception of the communities into which the aid is delivered. And so whatever we understand about what it is we're doing, then there's a likelihood that our best attempts would be misunderstood. And depressingly, I guess, that's something we've got to think about.
I think I might have found the middle ground, but I don't know. I agree with a lot of what both of you said, but I think that by being called Christian Aid, you are already evangelising more in a passive sort of way than the aggressive way that Nigel was talking about. You don't go in and say you can't have this unless you read the Bible or whatever, but by being called Christian Aid and acting as Christians, you're passively evangelising to people and saying this is who we are, this is what we believe in, and this is what we have to show for it, and this is how we love you, and this is because of who we are. So by being called Christian Aid and behaving in this way, you're passively evangelising to people without causing all the problems Nigel suggested that you could do by the other way.
Okay. Yeah, I agree with what you've just said. What I'm going to say is I work for Salvation Army in Zimbabwe currently, and I want to talk about an example where we went into a disaster situation after a cyclone, or the tail end of a cyclone, had come into Zimbabwe. And we went representing Jesus, but not actively evangelizing. There was no secret about where we came from and what we do. And then the people came back to us afterwards and said, please, can you bring your church? We like what you did. We love the way you did it. And now there is an active Salvation Army church. And we have since taken Bibles into them as well.
I want to go right to the back to give everybody a fair chance. Could you pass the microphone back to the windows?
In the UK, when we have disasters, part of the disaster plan will be the emotional and spiritual support for the people who have faced a disaster, whether it's a train crash or bombs and things. But that comes from the local communities who are around where the disaster is, like the local authorities. I know we're not talking about local authorities existing, but in many places of disaster, isn't it possible to draw just on the local community and support the local community leaders, spiritual leaders within the community, to provide what spiritual support is possible? I don't see how, if someone goes in from the outside, they can instantly provide that type of support to anybody from a different culture. So I don't see actually a conflict between what the two of you are saying, because one of you is talking about when you're already there and you know people and you're part of the culture, even if you've originally come from outside, and then you offer spiritual counsel and support a lot, and you offer aid. But if you go in a crisis overnight, you've no basis on which to know how to provide any type of spiritual or emotional support to people. You can only support those who can do it to carry it out themselves. So I don't see a conflict.
Yeah, Nigel, you mentioned that by giving evangelism and aid, you actually make the aid conditional on receiving the evangelism. But surely it isn't always the case that evangelism is, well, yeah, that the aid is conditional on the evangelism. Surely it's possible to offer Bibles or hold prayer meetings, but without saying you have to come to the prayer meeting to receive aid. You can still give aid anyway. So, the other thing was about the what Dave said about if a company is, well, organisation is already there to evangelise, if they then feel a need to give aid, should they then either give up evangelism or not give aid? Or so...
The lady from the Salvation Army, am I correct? I think she's answered the question. Wait for the people to ask first. You can't have healing and hope plus evangelism. You can have them separately, healing and hope and evangelism. But I think the question has been answered by the lady from Zimbabwe, was it? Yes, I think she's answered the question perfectly.
It was mentioned a little earlier that Christianity offers hope, etc. And fine, but surely other religions offer hope as well, and maybe one should be working with the leaders of other religions to bring that hope to the people that you're working with, and leave it to the to those who are actually involved in the spiritual side of things, but maybe the clergy or whatever, the local Christian or, and Muslim leaders.
Thank you. This is probably terribly naive, but if you give aid to three different people, they're going to receive it in three different ways. Seems a relationship problem. And it's not how you do it, it's how you make that relationship. And I think probably it seems to me we're forgetting that the people you're giving it to are empowered to think what they like about you. I mean, you can't control that. So why worry about this issue? Do it the way, way that's best.
Just following on from that, we've heard that you can't evangelize if you're not attentive to the physical needs of people. We've also heard that after a disaster, people need emotional care and support. So basically, the two are inseparable. But it's about being sensitive and being aware, forming relationships, we've heard, and being open to the Holy Spirit, I would say, to tell you what's needed at the moment.
It just seemed to me that Nigel and Peter were talking about like two separate extremes, but neither of you actually worked that way. Nigel's was sort of like the extreme, but you wouldn't operate that way, I would hope. And Peter, you seem a bit more in the middle. But it just seems to me that responding to individuals as they sort of come, you're doing the aid work, but as they, you know, if you're able to sort of by who you are with having a faith and the love of Jesus, so I'm getting very nervous, that would be communicated and people may, that may interest or want people to know more. It mightn't be in your lifetime, but, you know, sometime.
There's been a lot of mention about the power relationship created when you give aid. I would say that there's as much power relationship created when you do evangelism. And even if you've separated it, you are putting yourself in a power situation if you are evangelizing to these people and giving them the word. And you may as well be giving them food at the same time.
There you go. You're up for a straw poll about this? Okay. I'm actually the only person who can see what's going on in both corners, so I could make up the result if I wanted to.
Yeah, I can see now as well.
We'll ask you to say evangelism and aid should always be kept separate, or evangelism and aid can sensitively be brought together.
Do you feel he's rigging it somehow?
Okay. All right, let's put it another way. I'll ask you to vote, you're with Nigel or you're with Peter. Is that fair enough? Yeah. This is entirely unscientific. I don't even know, why did we decide to do this, Nigel?
I have no idea. It was your idea, I know that.
There you go. I didn't realise I was rigging it. There you go. But then I didn't realise I was holding people's... Never mind. Right, okay. Evangelism and aid should always be kept separate. Would you care to vote, please? Evangelism and aid can be brought together. Well, it's very, very close. Actually, so close, I wouldn't like without counting to be able to say. Which actually, Nigel, helps. Would you like to vote for the lady from Zimbabwe?
Peter and I are off now. The seminar will be finished by...
You know... we're running out of time, so do come and have a word with us afterwards. Okay? Yep. What? Okay, that's fine. We'll give you a space at the end. We've talked a lot about where your money goes when you give to Christian aid, and so now you know in very great detail what's going to happen to it. If you're approached by someone from Christian Aid during the course of the weekend who's asking you to think about giving in a more regular way, it would be lovely if you could take the opportunity of this green belt to think about that and to be good news for the poor as well as to as part of the ongoing legacy of what you've learned at Greenbelt this weekend and what you've enjoyed. Christian Aid have made it quite clear that the money the public has given through us has been used for emergency relief and counselling and reconstructing communities. It's definitely not been used to persuade people to change their religion. But of course, other organisations who've been working in the same place have been openly talking about the Christian faith to people who've lost everything. What motivates them? Well, love, I suppose. If you have a belief that faith in Jesus Christ is the only way to inherit eternal life, then to cross the world to people in crushing need, offering not only the resources that bring survival for the immediate future, but also a message of hope for all eternity, then it seems like the most loving and sacrificial thing that God could call you to do. We haven't properly touched on that in this debate because we thought the discussion would be derailed into talking about how to get to heaven instead of how to respond to an emergency on earth. But if you share those beliefs, the question is a setting of great poverty or crisis the best place or the worst place to arrive with an uncompromising message of salvation through Jesus alone?
I think as the questions went on, you'd partly rumbled us. We had, of course, slightly exaggerated the differences between our debate, between our argument, in order to encourage debate, and it was very interesting to listen to your responses. So where does that leave us in this complex debate? You may be less sure than what you used to be. You now may all be converted to the Salvation Army and persuaded by that argument, in which case Christian Aid's in trouble. But whatever your response, we hope that you have a better grasp of some of the complexities that aid agency has had to deal with in emergency situations, in conflict situations, and better equipped to think about it and make up your own mind. Which leaves us really with just one question to answer, which was the one we posed at the start. Would Christian Aid... Is that one on?
Yes.
Would Christian Aid buy Bibles for a hypothetical group post-emergency in a Christian country? Well, I thought, I'm not going to make up the answer. I'll go and get it from the horse's mouth. So I went and asked the head of Christian Aid's humanitarian division, Nick Gutman, and asked him. What did he say? No. But then he went on to say, I'd get Save the Children to do it. It's a good answer. He said, in a disaster, it's vital that we look after people's whole well-being. It's vital that we look after their spiritual well-being as well. So if a local community group that we were working with identified Bibles as an absolute priority, he'd want to give them. But he says it's far too easy to misrepresent a Christian agency giving out Bibles in an aid and disaster situation. So he wouldn't do it. He'd get a secular organization to do it, because their motives will not be so suspicious. He said, if people really needed Bibles, and that's what they came in, and that's what they asked for, I wouldn't give them, but I'd make sure someone else did. Thank you for coming.
I thought it was...